And for the next Pope, we're also going to take you to the heart of Western Sydney. It's going to be a very decisive area in this weekend's federal election to hear about how religion might influence the vote. That's ahead on Radio National.
ABC News, I'm Thanmaya Navadar. With just 3 days until polling day, the Greens will hold its official campaign launch in Melbourne tonight. The launch will focus on the party's election pledge to get dental into Medicare, with the Greens revealing the policy would save families more than $2,600 in its first year. Analysis by the Parliamentary Budget Office also found the Greens' proposed tax on big corporations and billionaires would generate $577 billion. Greens leader Adam Bandt says he's hopeful of introducing universal free dental care by the end of the year if there are enough Greens in Parliament.
We're heading towards a minority parliament, according to the experts. Last time there was a minority parliament, the Greens got dental into Medicare for kids. Now we want to finish the job and get dental into Medicare for everyone.
The federal opposition is accusing Labor of secretly planning to legislate a voice to parliament in a second term. Foreign Minister Penny Wong today walked back comments she made to the Batuta Advocate podcast, which opposition leader Peter Dutton claimed showed Labor's intent to establish the Indigenous Advisory Body. Mr. Dutton claims the comments suggested a resurrected Indigenous voice was inevitable.
You see Penny Wong out there at the moment talking about the fact that the voice is inevitable. So under a Labor-Greens government, we see this secret plan to legislate the voice, and Penny Wong's let that cat out of the bag. Now, people will be opposed to that because they thought they sent a very clear message to the Prime Minister that they didn't want the voice.
Economists expect inflation to moderate further as a result of US President Donald Trump's tariffs and his trade war with China. The latest consumer price index data shows core inflation slowed to 2.9% in the 12 months to March, suggesting price pressure is easing. AMP economist Deanna Messina is backing the rate cut when the Reserve Bank meets next month and expects US tariffs to lower prices here as Chinese products make their way to Australian shelves.
In the last month, we've had more downside risks to global growth and global trade because of the Trump tariffs, some even potentially deflationary impacts to Australia through the tariffs if we get cheaper global products onto our market.
Lawyers for the woman accused of murdering three of her relatives by serving poisonous mushrooms at a lunch in regional Victoria have argued it was a terrible accident, not a deliberate act. She continues to maintain her innocence, as Jared Whittaker reports.
Erin Patterson is standing trial in the Supreme Court, charged with murdering three relatives and attempting to kill another. Prosecutors allege she invited them to lunch in July 2023 under false pretenses. Prosecutors told the court phone records tracked her going to locations known as foraging spots for deathcap mushrooms and claimed she served her guests lunch on different coloured plates to her own. In an opening address, her defence lawyer admitted she lied to police when she said she bought the mushrooms from a shop and lied about dumping a food dehydrator. The defence said the lunch was a tragic accident and she panicked after her guests fell ill. The trial continues tomorrow.
The Northern Territory government has strengthened its bail laws, passing new legislation through Parliament today. Isabella Tolhurst has the details.
Darwin shopkeeper Linford Fyke was allegedly stabbed to death by a man on bail last week, triggering a swift response from the CLP government. In an urgent Parliament sitting today, they passed new laws, which require a judge to be satisfied a person is not a risk to the community before they're released on bail.
The question is that the bill be now read a third time. Those of that opinion say aye. I think the ayes have it.
The bill is inspired by those in Victoria but has been met with criticism from the Justice Reform Initiative.
Prison doesn't work as a deterrent and it doesn't work as a mechanism for behaviour change.
The bill passed through Parliament within 5 hours.
The NT's Children's Commissioner, Charlena Musk, says she's devastated the laws have passed without consultation.
I've written on multiple occasions to relevant ministers and around reforms to the youth justice system, to the child protection system, and I've not got a response to that. I've not been invited to the table to have discussions about what works, what doesn't work, what needs to change, building off the data and what we know.
Victoria's fire danger period has been extended beyond the start of May for the first time since 2019, as parts of the state face elevated fire risk long after the end of summer. The CFA says the move has been driven by a near-record lack of rainfall and a warmer-than-average autumn. Much of the state's southwest will face fire restrictions for another 2 to 3 weeks. You're listening to ABC News.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the prosecution outlines its case against Victorian woman Erin Patterson, accused of killing 3 people with poisonous mushrooms. Also, the latest inflation figures are in, boosting expectations of interest rate cuts. And a man reunited with his cherished fishing rod 40 years after it went overboard.
And I said to them, just hold, I want to have a look at it before it goes back over the side. And I seen it was a custom-made rod and it had an actual name on it. And it turned out the guy was still alive and his son was on holidays in Bermagui.
First this evening to the trial of a Victorian woman accused of murdering 3 relatives and the attempted murder of another by serving them a meal containing poisonous mushrooms. The prosecution has laid out its case against Erin Patterson in the Supreme Court sitting in the regional Victorian town of Morwell. The jury has heard that police allege Ms. Patterson served her own food on a distinctive plate, attempted to destroy evidence, lied about a cancer diagnosis and refused medical treatment for both herself and her children. Ms. Patterson has consistently maintained her innocence and has pleaded not guilty to the charges. Our reporter Kathleen O'Connor is following the proceedings. Kathleen, what is the crux of the prosecution's case?
Sam, the prosecution told the jury that on July 29, 2023, Erin Patterson invited her former in-laws Don and Gail Patterson and Ian and Heather Wilkinson over for lunch at her home in Langatha in country Victoria, where she allegedly deliberately poisoned them by hiding death cap mushrooms in the beef Wellington dish she served to them. The court heard that Erin Patterson invited the 4 of them over to discuss her recent cancer diagnosis. Prosecutor Nanette Rogers alleges that Don and Gail Patterson and Ian and Heather Wilkinson were served on the same plates, but Ms. Patterson served herself on a smaller plate, which was also a different colour. Later that night, the 4 guests got sick and were transferred to a hospital in Melbourne. A few days later, Gail Patterson, Don Patterson and Heather Wilkinson died. Ian Patterson was the only survivor. The prosecution also alleges that the accused attempted to destroy evidence, including a dehydrator with traces of toxic mushrooms with Ms. Patterson's fingerprints on them.
And the jury's heard today, Kathleen, that the victims ended up in hospital. But what was the court told about Erin Patterson's attitude to getting medical treatment?
That's right, Sam. Prosecutor Nanette Rogers also told the court that 2 days after the mushroom lunch, Erin Patterson allegedly called her ex-husband Simon, telling him that she'd been unwell and she drove herself to hospital. The prosecution alleges that she told doctors she also fed her children leftovers but scraped the mushrooms off when doctors urged her to pull them out of school for treatment. Erin Patterson allegedly told them, I don't want to get them involved. The court heard that she also refused treatment herself, signing a discharge against medical advice form, but later then returned to hospital where doctors cleared her of poisoning and was just discharged later.
And what did the prosecution tell the court about where Erin Patterson allegedly got the mushrooms?
Now, there's a few different versions, according to the prosecution. Crown Prosecutor Nanette Rogers SC said that when the accused was first asked about where she got the mushrooms, she first answered her local Woolworths. Later, when asked by medical professionals, Erin Patterson then told them that half of them were from Woolworths and the other half were from an Asian grocer. The accused then told authorities she couldn't remember what Asian grocery she bought them from. The court heard that health experts then checked all Asian groceries grocers in the three suburbs listed by the accused, but were unable to find anything resembling what the accused had described to police. The jury was also told the accused took photos of deathcap mushrooms before the lunch and sent them to a website.
And just briefly, Kathleen, the prosecution, I understand, wrapped up its opening today. What's the defence told the court?
Yeah, that's right, Sam. Erin Patterson's defence lawyer, Colin Mandy SC, argues that she panicked because three people died because of the food that she served to them, saying Miss Patterson admits that she lied to police about foraging for mushrooms and getting rid of the dehydrator. Justice Christopher Beale ended the day reminding the jury that the information given today are just allegations and the evidence will be presented to them through the course of the trial. Erin Patterson maintains her innocence, pleading not guilty to three charges of murder and one charge of attempted murder. The trial is expected to go to 5 to 6 weeks, Sam.
Kathleen, thank you. Kathleen O'Connor following the trial of Erin Patterson in Morwell in regional Victoria. New inflation data out today shows the pace of rising prices is slowing, but not quite as much as some economists expected. Even so, the news is being welcomed by the federal government, coming as it does just a few days before the election. And with a crucial measure of inflation now back within the Reserve Bank's target range, the figures are boosting expectations of further interest rate cuts. Nick Grimm has more.
For Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers, today's inflation figures should reassure Australian voters to re-elect the Albanese government.
This is a powerful demonstration of the progress that Australians have made together under Labor on inflation and on the economy more broadly as well.
The data actually shows the consumer price index rising in the March quarter, though that was expected, due in part to the impact of price increases coinciding with the new calendar year. The 2.4% CPI increase did come in fractionally higher than the expectations of most economists, but the Treasurer argues it's still better than earlier forecasts.
These numbers are better than the budget assumed only five and a bit weeks ago. So we're actually ahead of schedule compared to the forecasts in the budget. They forecast 2.6. And we've got a 2.4 today.
But the opposition says the result shows the nation is not yet out of the economic woods and the path ahead is shrouded with uncertainty. Shadow Treasurer Angus Taylor.
And what we see is that this cost of living crisis is far from over. It continues on. The only person who thinks that the cost of living crisis is over is the Treasurer. And he is wrong. There is a long, long way to go. And what we see in this data is headline inflation above the target range, and we also see core inflation right at the top of the target range.
However, the data also reveals the more closely watched trim mean or underlying inflation figure is down to just 2.9%, just within the RBA's preferred target band for keeping inflation under control. Dr. Shane Oliver is the chief economist at AMP.
So the numbers are a little bit higher than expected. That said, they are still going in the right direction. We've got the overall headline inflation number around the target at 2.4%, and we've got underlying inflation falling below 3%, and don't forget the target range is 2 to 3%. We've got that rate falling to 2.9% from 3.3%. That's the first time it's been back in the target, I think, since 2021. In fact, it is the lowest since December 2021. So it's good news. It's just not quite as good as some, including ourselves, had been hoping.
There is good news in store for households struggling with high mortgage payments, though, with consensus among many economists that there will be another interest rate cut in May. But recent predictions of a potential reduction of around 0.5% now appear less likely to be fulfilled. Michaela Ficella is chief economist at the investment and advisory firm Jarden.
We've made the case that the RBA does not have a reason to panic and do a large move to cut by 50 basis points or more. 25 basis points seems consistent with the RBA current view that, you know, the economy is soft, the labour market's starting to look a little bit less tight.
On the upside, though, economists are still tipping there'll be more rate cuts to come before the year is out. Others, though, are warning people shouldn't just assume those cuts are guaranteed. Leonora Rees is an associate professor in economics at the University of Canberra.
The Reserve Bank is still going to be watching to see what happens as a result of those global factors before it can decisively make a move on interest rates.
It does sound like you're suggesting that now is a time for caution rather than bold and decisive action from the RBA.
I think the timing is one where the Reserve Bank has certainly landed in their narrow path, but they've done so right at a time when external global factors have really exacerbated. So we're now entering another stage of uncertainty. And I think so far the way that the RBA has communicated is one of caution. And the market, I think the market has certainly pointed towards an expectation of rate cuts. But we also know that if we rewind, say 6 months, the markets were also forecasting a rate cut then, and that didn't necessarily transpire because I think the Reserve Bank's responsibility is also to weigh up some of those headwinds against inflation as well. So still a bit of a moving picture globally.
That's Associate Professor Leonora Rees from Canberra University. Nick Grimm reporting. For all the issues that have been debated during this election campaign, one topic that's rarely come up with the major parties is the protection of native wildlife. Australia has the highest mammal extinction rate of any continent in the world, and conservationists and environmental scientists say they're frustrated the crisis hasn't been on the election agenda. Nadine Haynes reports.
While parliamentarians haven't been talking a lot about the issue this election campaign, surveys show that Australians do care about protecting the natural environment.
96% of Australians want to see more action to look after nature, but they're also telling us that Australians just expect the government to be doing its job.
Director of the Biodiversity Council, James Tresice, says late last year the council surveyed 3,500 Australians, and two-thirds said they were extremely concerned about the loss of plants and animals where they live. When people in the survey were asked to list the issues they would like politicians to prioritise, cost of living came in at number one. But there were four others vying closely for second place. They were housing, healthcare, the economy and the environment.
The Australian government's independent report found that Australia's environment is in a poor and deteriorating state. We've got more than 2,200 species and ecosystems on our threatened species list. We've got 17 ecosystems that have been formally identified on the brink of collapse.
James Tresice says the government has not lived up to its promises from the 2022 election campaign, and he's disappointed it hasn't been more of a prominent issue in this campaign.
The Albanese government came to power promising to reform our national environmental laws, and where we ended up was with no reform taking us forward and actually a further weakening of what are inadequate environmental laws just before the election was called. So we've actually gone backwards, and so the government has not delivered its promises, and that's a real shame because there is a real opportunity here to strengthen our nature laws for the country.
He also thinks that conservation is chronically underfunded.
The federal government has tried to use cups of water to pull out a blazing fire. We see less than 6 cents out of every $100 of taxpayers' money go to on-ground conservation programs. And so one of the key reasons that we are in this extinction crisis, in this biodiversity crisis, is because the federal government doesn't step up, doesn't invest the money that is needed to protect and restore the iconic species that Australians love.
Professor Leslie Hughes is an environmental scientist and director of the Climate Council. She agrees that more funding needs to be allocated to helping the environment.
Well, it's nowhere near enough. If we consider that biodiversity is basically our life support system, you know, we are nothing without nature and we are part of nature, to spend so little is just really, truly appalling.
Do you think politicians understand how much people care about nature?
Well, no, I don't think they do, because if they did, nature would have been a bit more of a topic in the pre-election period, and clearly it hasn't been.
There seems to be an increasing amount of animals that are becoming extinct.
Well, yes, we've got the highest rate of mammal loss, for example, of any continent in the world. So since European colonisation, at least 50 animals and 50 plant species have gone extinct, and there are many, many more at risk of extinction.
Then there are those that are on the threatened species list and on the brink of extinction, including the koala, the Tasmanian devil, and the northern hairy-nosed wombat. There are also species we take for granted, such as parrots, cockatoos, finches, quolls, gliders, wallabies, frogs, snakes and fish. With such urgency, it's perhaps surprising that it isn't a bigger election issue. Tony Barry from political polling and research organisation Redbridge Group says right now voters are fixated on one thing, and it's not the environment.
The cost of living crisis is bigger. So in all recent research, cost of living is the number one issue for around 75% of Australians right now. Cost of living is so pervasive that people cannot think beyond the next month and sometimes the next week. Public opinion is never static. It'll change, and I'm sure it'll become more salient again if cost of living pressures are reduced somewhat.
But Professor Leslie Hughes says the extinction crisis is real and it's only going to get more dire unless we do something about it.
Environmentalists and nature lovers include the vast majority of Australians, want our governments to take responsibility for the nature that we have. Australia has so many species that occur nowhere else on the planet. Many of those species we have lost already, and many more of them are in danger. And I would certainly like to see our politicians support stronger nature laws and make decisions that are in the best interests of the country, and that includes our nature.
Professor Leslie Hughes is the Director of the Climate Council. Nadine Haynes reporting. Well, if you want to know how your views compare with those of the major political parties this election, just head to the ABC News website where you'll find the Vote Compass tool. You can answer a few quick questions and see where you sit on the political spectrum. Just head to abc.net.au/VoteCompass. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a man reunited with a treasured fishing rod 40 years after it was washed overboard. Vietnam is today marking 50 years since the fall of Saigon and the end of the war between the countries north and south. From April 1975, more than 3,000 war orphan children were evacuated from Saigon to countries around the world, including Australia, as Rachel Hayter reports.
In Ho Chi Minh City, a grand military parade celebrates 50 years ago today, since the end of the Vietnam War.
We were overwhelmed with joy. People came out and cheered for us. So happy.
This 69-year-old veteran was a truck driver in the war, bringing troops and supplies from the north to the south along the Ho Chi Minh trails.
I've no words to express the happiness for the soldiers who came to Saigon on that day. So much happiness.
On the 30th of April in 1975, North Vietnamese tanks crashed through the gates of the presidential palace in Saigon. It marked the fall of the US-backed South Vietnamese government and the reunification of the country under communist rule.
I'm very happy and very proud of my country, Vietnam. The 50th anniversary is a symbol of peace and happiness.
3 million Vietnamese, 60,000 Americans and 500 Australians were killed in the Vietnam War. 20 years of bloody conflict tore Vietnamese families apart and orphaned thousands of children, many of whom were airlifted to Australia. Among them, Rohan Samara, who arrived here in a cardboard box at just 3 months old. He first returned to his birth country when he was 39.
Having the Vietnamese hug you and saying welcome home was absolutely incredible, and there was lots of tears.
Rohan Samara, who lives in Canberra, raises money for DNA kits that can be used by those Vietnamese mothers who were separated from their babies or gave them away during the war, many of them fathered by American soldiers. He's among many Vietnamese-Australian war orphans rebuilding their connections to Vietnam.
You need to be in the really right mental health space to go there, because you're opening up a lot of unknowns. You're opening up a lot of feelings, and there could be a lot of hurt at the end of it. So you just don't know. So The Vietnamese, when people leave the country and you come back, everyone just welcomes you home.
Dr. Indigo Willing is the founder of Adopted Vietnamese International.
As a war orphan from the Vietnam War, every time it's April 1975, you're filled with a lot of emotions, and it's a really emotional time, I think, for anyone that was part of an orphanage and evacuated to the West. It's a very heavy time because you kind of get survivor's guilt and think, why me? At the same time, you think what you've lost because you were separated from your country of birth and your, you know, not just your birth parents, but maybe siblings, grandparents, your ancestors.
She says historically, Operation Baby Lift, as it was called, has been framed as an altruistic humanitarian mission. But she believes it was also the product of a Cold War attitude that West is best.
It was a very hectic time, and the pilots and the volunteers of that time can attest to that there wasn't much process, that people were being shot at, the planes were being shot at, people were fleeing, basically. So there wasn't sort of really great paperwork during Baby Lift. And some of the genuine families that were still connected lost their children. And on the other hand, there were genuine orphans as well that were adopted overseas. So it was very, very complicated. It wasn't sort of like an easy process to, I guess, glorify. There are questions to be asked in the wake of that kind of evacuation so that in the future conflicts and in disasters, children aren't sort of, you know, removed en masse from their culture and their possibly surviving families without any information on where they've gone for those families.
That's the founder of the organisation Adopted Vietnamese International, Dr. Indigo Willing. Rachel Hayter with that report. Well, if you've ever experienced losing something really special and then having it turn up years later out of the blue, you'll probably relate to this story. A commercial fishing crew has hauled up a 40-year-old fishing rod off the south coast of New South Wales, and now it's been handed back to its owner. Floss Adams tells the story.
Andrew Wintle has found many surprising items in his fishing net over the decades, but one recent catch has proven to be special. He's the skipper of the Imlay, a red trawler that calls the Bermagui Harbour home on the New South Wales far south coast.
Basically, we're just hauling in the net as usual, and the boys put out an old fishing rod out the front of Bermagui in about 120 fathoms of water. And I said to them, just hold, I want to have a look at it before it goes back over the side. And seeing it was a custom-made rod, and it looked around the 80s, and it had an actual name on it, and I recognised the initials Victoria Game Fishing Club. And there I just thought I'd text a couple of mates, just out of curiosity, that are in that sort of game fishing area. And it turned out the guy was still alive, and his son was on holidays in Bermagui.
And that son was Trent Ellis.
It's like finding a needle in a haystack. My phone starts going berserk with messages coming through from friends and family that fishing rod had been posted on Facebook and that it had my dad's name written on it, Bob Ellis. Not in 1985, it went overboard. So first thing we did was try and find out where it was and who had it.
Trent's dad, Bob Ellis, is a life member of the Victorian Game Fishing Club and has been fishing most of his life. He couldn't believe his old fishing rod had been pulled from the deep after four decades.
I remember it like it was yesterday, because you don't lose a game fishing rod every day of the week. There was three of us on the boat and we'd all hooked up on a fish. We got into a school of fish and we were all fighting fish and Richard Tarossi, he was a junior then, I think he was only 14 or 15 years old. He'd got his fish to the boat and I said to him, look, I'll come over and gaff your fish. And I put my rod in the rod holder. And it was the rod holder, I'm facing out the sea. And I turned my back, went over to gaff it, and next minute I just saw the rod just take off. What had happened was my fish was down deep because big yellowfin fight down deep all the time, and that's how they fight, and they don't come to the surface, you know, very often. And this one had obviously changed its mind and it came straight up to the surface. And that's why the rod came out of the rod holder. We all turned and looked at it and there it is bouncing across the surface. That was the end of the rod. Well, it wasn't the end of the rod. We got it back 40 years later.
It's just a bit of history, you know. Like, would you remember that day if you didn't find the rod? You know, would it, they probably were having an exciting day fishing out there, the three of them. And this is just another thing to put in the trophy room and it's a memory and, you know, the grandkids will get it one day and they've got a story to tell.
For Bob Ellis, the fact that the fishing rod was found almost 40 years later is astonishing, but even more special for the 83-year-old fisherman has been the connections that would not have otherwise been made.
Everybody has been absolutely amazed about it and all spoken about it and now they've become friends.
And for the Imlay skipper, Andrew Wintle.
When you pull up the next rod, will you be checking for a name?
Absolutely. And hopefully it's got a wonderful story like this one.
There can't be too many of those. That's fisherman Andrew Wintle from Bermagui on the New South Wales South Coast. That report from Floss Adams. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Radio National. Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West with you, and it's election season. And later in the show, we're going to take you to an election where only about 140 people get to vote. It's the election of a new pope. A conclave begins soon, but even though it's a sacred election, so to speak, there's still politics. But before they choose a new pope, Australians will choose the next government. And as we do at every election, we're going to look beyond the day's headlines and ask where issues of religion, immigration, ethnicity and identity could be factors. We're here in Parramatta, just off a rather rainy square, because Western Sydney is one of several regions around Australia where the votes of multicultural communities could be decisive. And I don't think we could have chosen two better people to discuss these issues. Melissa Montero heads the Community Migrant Resource Centre here in Parramatta. She's also the author of the book The Girl from Mumbai. And Professor Awais Paracha is a specialist in demography and urban planning at Western Sydney University. It's so good to have you both here.
Thank you.
Awais, let's start with you. Western Sydney is a big part of the story. It's not the only part of the story. Where across Australia could religious identity and religious observance play a role?